Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Glow versus Union Insurance Company. For the appellant, Union Insurance Company, is Ms. Paula Lind from the Schaefer Law Office in Sioux Falls. Is it Lind? Is that correctly?
Lindy.
Okay, thank you. And for the appellee, Michael Glow, is Nancy Turbeck, attorney from Watertown. Mr. Lindy, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Your Honor, I'm here today representing the interests of Union Insurance Company. This case arises out of a vehicle accident in which Larry and Verna May Glow were killed by a vehicle driven by Donald Huber. The vehicle driven by Donald Huber was a van owned by another party. At the time of the accident, Donald Huber himself had $100,000 in single limits insurance coverage. The van's owner and the van itself had $25,000 of single limit insurance coverage. Larry and Verna May Glow, who are the parents of Michael Glow, both passed away shortly after this accident. After the accident, the insurance companies, on behalf of Mr. Donald Huber, the insurance companies being Farmers Insurance and American Family Insurance, paid a total of $125,000 for the death and bodily injury of Verna May Glow. The insurance companies, on behalf of Mr. Huber, also paid $125,000 for the death and bodily injury of Larry Glow. Michael Glow, today, in his case, is arguing that Union Insurance Company, which is the insurance company that had insurance of Mr. and Mrs. Glow, must pay him underinsured motorist benefits. Union Insurance Company has denied that Michael Glow is entitled to underinsured motorist benefits. The union policy that was issued to Mr. Glow's parents had underinsured limits of $100,000 per person and $300,000 per accident. The first thing that required denial of underinsured motorist benefits in this case is the South Dakota statute SDCL 58-11-9.5. That is the underinsured motorist statute in this case. There is specific language in that statute that provides.
If I could interrupt for a minute, I assume since this is unstipulated facts that there is no question of fact. We're just looking at a question of law, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
SDCL 58-11-9.5 provides in relevant part, coverage shall be limited to the underinsured motorist coverage limits on the vehicle of the party recovering, less the amount paid by the liability insurers of the party recovering against. Clearly under this statute, the focus of the statute is the amount of insurance or the amount of payment that was paid by the tortfeasor. In this case, the amount of money that was paid by the tortfeasor was $125,000, both for Larry Glow and an additional $125,000 for Verna May Glow. Now, the plain language of the statute would not allow a recovery in this case. That's the simple math of this is that you take the $125,000 that was paid on behalf of the tortfeasor, who's Donald Huber in this case, and you consider the amount of underinsured motorist benefits that Mr. Glow's parents had purchased, which is $100,000. Because the $125,000 exceeds the amount of available underinsured motorist coverage of $100,000, there's an offset. There's no underinsured motorist coverage under the statute. This is consistent with the court's previous decision in Farmland versus Heitman. In Heitman, a young girl was killed by a drunk driver. The drunk driver, similar to the driver in this case, had $125,000 in coverage. That came from two separate policies, one covering the vehicle and one covering the driver. The parents of the little girl in Heitman claimed that they were not fully compensated by the $125,000 and made a claim against their underinsured motorist coverage. Their underinsured motorist carrier denied the claim, stating that they had been paid $125,000 by the driver's liability carrier and the carrier for the vehicle. Court, interpreting the underinsured motorist statute in that decision, concluded that South Dakota is a difference in the limit state. And basically what that means is the court looks at the amount of underinsured motorist benefits that is available, which was $100,000 in that case, and you offset the amount paid by the liability insurer in that case. Essentially, what Mr. Glow's position in this case is that he's a wrongful death beneficiary, and that he's essentially limited in his offset to the amount that he, as a wrongful death beneficiary, received under the policy.
Now, you made the same argument to Judge Tim, and he decided against you, right?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. And what went wrong?
Why was Judge Tim wrong, in my understanding?
Yes. Direction?
I think why Judge Tim was wrong, Your Honor, is basically I think what Michael Glow's position has always been is that for his father's death, he received, as a wrongful death beneficiary, $40,000. And I'm rounding the exact figures because I don't know them off the top of my head. And also for his mother's death, he received $40,000. But I think what the trial court did wrong is it improperly concluded, based upon the statute, that you look at the amounts paid to somebody, when in fact, what this court looks at is the amount paid by. The court looks at the amount paid by the tortfeasor in the case. And I think this is consistent with the court's previous authority on this issue. Michael Glow cannot point to any authority that would support this court's interpretation of an underinsured motorist policy as he interprets it. Instead, when the court was faced with this issue, as in Heitman, it didn't consider the amount paid to the wrongful death beneficiaries. In Heitman, remember, we had the little girl that died, and we had the parents making a claim against the insurance policy. Also, there's the case that this court considered in Hovall. Troy Hovall was killed by a truck down in Texas, and he argued that Texas law applied to the underinsured motorist claim. This court considered that, and the fact that the tortfeasor's insured paid $100,000, and he only had $100,000 in underinsured motorist coverage. Now, the court did not consider any possible claims by a beneficiary. The offset simply was this. It was the amount paid on behalf of the tortfeasor, which was then offset against the amount of underinsured motorist benefits. I think to follow Michael Glow's argument through in this case, what the court needs to do, and to go back to your question, Justice, I think what the court did improperly at the trial court level was it added language to SDCL 5811-9.5. Under 5811-9.5, as I previously stated, what the court must consider is the amount paid by the tortfeasor. What the trial court did is it looked at the amount paid to the wrongful death claimant or to the insured in this case. Now, why did the court look at that? And I think there was a good argument made by Michael Glow based upon this Broughton decision out of Minnesota. And where that case is from, it's a decision from the 80s that this court relied on in Heitman. And the reliance on the Broughton decision in Heitman by this court was because the Heitmans were making the argument that there couldn't be an offset until payment was actually made. The Broughton decision considered this specific issue. And in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that timing didn't matter. This court then relied on that decision to reject the Heitmans' argument that timing mattered. Now, interestingly, in that case, the Minnesota case I'm talking about, the Broughton decision, they considered a different underinsured motorist statute. That statute considered the amount that was actually paid to the insured. Our statute is different than the Minnesota statute. Our statute considers the amount paid by the tortfeasor's liability insurer. And I think the court was convinced considering that Broughton decision, but I don't think that the Heitman decision issued by this court in any way adopts the underinsured motorist statute that was considered in the Minnesota decision in Broughton. And I think there's also the issue that is raised in this case by Mr. Glow, and he claims to have some type of independent type claim because he is a wrongful death beneficiary. And I think this is inconsistent, because I think what he has is he has a claim that is derived from the death of his parents. In Rogers versus Allied Mutual, which was a case decided by this court in 1994, the court considered a situation where a husband made a claim for his loss of consortium. His wife was injured in the accident. She suffered a bodily injury. Her liability insurer paid $50,000. She had underinsured motorist coverage of $50,000 per person, $100,000 each occurrence. Her husband made a claim for loss of consortium, claiming that he was not limited to the $50,000 policy limits, but he should make a per occurrence claim for his loss of consortium. This court rejected that reading of the policy, and instead, because it was a derivative claim, found that he was limited to the per person limits of $50,000. We've also cited in our brief decisions from other jurisdictions, such as the Davis opinion out of West Virginia. Now, this decision recognized that each wrongful death claimant does not get their individual limits. And the reasoning behind this case, as well as the other cases cited concluding the same, is that a wrongful death claim is essentially a derivative claim. Because it's a derivative.
Let me just interrupt you on that. The statute on the wrongful death, however, is for the benefit of the beneficiaries, is it not? How do you resolve that language with your analysis of the underinsured?
I think there's two issues that arise and in resolving that. Number one, I think that 2555 SDCL provides that the wrongful death claim is brought by the personal representative. So I think the personal representative is the party that's legally entitled to recover. But
the damages are all dependent upon the beneficiaries and their losses, aren't they?
That's true. The damages are after there's payment to the estate, then they're divided among the beneficiaries as to how they would deserve or what they should get under that amount that is paid.
Well, how are the damages, what's your understanding of how the damages are? Let's say this goes to a trial or somebody's looking at the amount of damages, and how do you figure the amount of damages for wrongful death?
Well, I think it's the pecuniary loss under the statute is what it is. And I'm not...
Of the beneficiaries.
Right, of the beneficiaries. And I think this court, I think in the Watson decision, essentially recognized, which we haven't cited in our brief, but I think it's a previous decision, that can vary from $1 to any amount depending on what that beneficiary has provided to the decedent. But I think...
Now you're citing the authority that's not in your brief, is that right?
Right, I'm just referring to that case as where the court looks at pecuniary damages. I think it's cited by Mr. Glow in his brief.
All right.
Not as authority for any position, but just as clarification on what the court looks at.
Apparently there's no dispute of fact that Mr. Glow's pecuniary loss exceeded the $40,000 he received.
Not for the purposes of our stipulation, Your Honor. How we stipulated that was that we would stipulate for purposes of this declaratory judgment that he could have damages in excess of the amount that he received, actually.
Could have or did have?
Well, for the purposes of this action.
Right, but the language you used was could have or did have.
I believe it was did have for the purposes of this, but we weren't admitting that as a factual issue if we were entitling us to contest it later at a later time as to his actual damages.
back one before you move to a new subject. Following up on what Justice Meyer Henry asked you, how does the Weatherby case from the Iowa Supreme Court apply to this issue about, you know, whether the claim has to be brought by the estate or not?
I think the Weatherby decision, Your Honor, is the Iowa decision, and I think that that decision was specifically considering the Iowa underinsured motorist statute. In that decision, there wasn't a policy that the court was looking at because nobody had put it in the record. And the court simply had the statute to look at and determine whether they were legally entitled to recover. And I think I'll further answer your question by moving on to what the policy in this case says, because I think it's instructive as to a wrongful death claim, if that's okay with the court. In this case, the clear language of the case, or of the policy, provides that the limited liability provision, which limits the maximum amount that's payable for underinsured motorist claims, is $100,000 for all damages for the care, loss of service, or death arising out of the bodily injury sustained by any one person in one accident. Now, that's $100,000 for Larry Glow, and it's $100,000 for Vernon Mayglow. And the policy further provides this is regardless of the number of insureds or the number of claims made. Therefore, considering that language, there's $100,000. That's the maximum that union would ever have to pay. Now, you follow the language of the policy through, and we go to subparagraph B under the limited liability provision. Subparagraph B is very clear. It states, all sums paid because of the bodily injury by or behalf of the person who is legally responsible is offset against that $100,000. Now, the bodily injury includes the death and all damages from that, and that's clear from the limit of liability provision. When we read those two together, the $125,000, which was paid on behalf of the death of Vernon Glow, and $125,000, which was paid for Larry Glow, is offset against that $100,000 in the limit of liability provision. Now, and I think this is a real weakness with Michael Glow's argument. He essentially is adding language to the policy to say that all sums paid to the insured. Essentially, what he's trying to do is he's trying to limit this offset clause and the limit of liability provision to make the argument that, no, you only look at all amounts that were paid to me, the wrongful death beneficiary. You don't look to all amounts that were paid on behalf of the bodily injury. And I think that's a real weakness in this case. The maximum...
Is there anything in the policy language that changes that, that gives rise to the argument that it's the correct way to look at it is the amount paid to somebody?
I don't think that there is, and I think the argument, I think what the court may be referring to is the argument that's been proposed by Mr. Glow's attorney, where he's essentially saying that he's legally entitled to recover. But I think what's happening is that I think various portions of the policy are being parsed out and read separately. And I think what the court needs to do is read the whole underinsured provision, which the limit of liability and the offset is a very important provision, because if you didn't have that, then you can't consider other payments that were made on behalf of the tortfeasor. I don't know if that answered your question, but I guess I tried to.
You bet. Thanks.
Yep. Now, going back to the policy and Michael Glow's reading of the policy, essentially how he would read that is that all sums paid to the insured are offset against this amount. So that he's essentially saying, and this is necessarily his argument, because if the court looks at the policy, there was $100,000 paid for the, or there was $125,000 paid for the death of Vernon Mayglow. There was $125,000 paid for the death of Larry Glow. Now, when we look at that, each of them would have a limit under the maximum, and then the maximum amount for their liability would be $100,000. Each of them would have a limit. So what Scott, and then offset that, so you don't have any limits left. But what Scott Glow is doing is essentially creating his own limit by saying, well, there's another $100,000 out there for wrongful death beneficiaries. And then I get a set off $40,000 because I'm a wrongful death beneficiary. And I think that's inconsistent with how the policy should be read, which is an offset of all sums. And you only get any type of ambiguity, as argued by the appellee in this case, if you add the language that Mr. Glow is adding to the policy, which says all sums paid to the insured, which he adds into the policy. So I don't think the policy is ambiguous. Your Honor, basically, the position of Union Insurance has been that South Dakota follows its underinsured motorist statute. Under the underinsured motorist statute, the court must consider the amount paid by the liability insurer for the tortfeasor. This is consistent with its other decisions in Heitman and in Hovall. In addition, the policy would also bar coverage as previously discussed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundy. Mr. Rick, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. Greetings to the court, counsel, and clerks. Thank you for the opportunity of being here. This case is about how to handle the set-off between underinsured motorist coverage and liability insurance that has to be made so that you can figure out how much UIM coverage there is in any particular case.
You also agree, then, that there's no factual issue, it's just pure legal
right.
question.
This is a matter of law submitted on stipulated facts, and incidentally, Justice, the stipulation with regard to uncompensated damages was the stipulation, the agreement was that Michael Glow, for purposes of this action, will be assumed to have not been fully compensated for the death of either parent. The issue is, when an insured has UIM coverage, may his insurer deduct from his stated UIM liability limits amounts paid to anyone, or can it only deduct amounts that liability insurers paid to the claimant? That's the issue here. There is no dispute that Michael Glow is an insured under this UIM policy. There's no dispute that the policy limits we're talking about are $100,000 per person, $300,000 per occurrence. There's no dispute about the fact that the UIM insurer in this case has paid no portion of any limit. No one else has even made a claim under this policy, and not $1 of UIM benefits has been paid to anyone. And as I've indicated, there's no dispute about the fact that Michael Glow has uncompensated damages as a result of the negligence of underinsured motorist. Michael Glow's claims claim is that there is a $100,000 limit, gross limit, of UIM benefits available for each of his two claims. He acknowledges that there should be a set-off for amounts paid by the liability insurer. And the issue is, do you set off the amounts paid to him by the liability insurer on each of the claims, or do you set off the total amount that a liability insurer may have paid to everyone? Or as the insurer has argued repeatedly in the brief, you just subtract the limits of the liability insurance policy. And the insurer would like to say that all the court needs to look at is the language paid by the liability insurer, and that it somehow ought to put on blinders and not ask any other questions about those payments. But if you think for a moment about that, the results would be absurd. If the only thing an insurer ever had to prove is that it had paid amounts, but with no other boundaries, they're not even saying when they paid it. Is it only on this accident? Is it this calendar year? Is it this week? Obviously, there's some anticipation that the paid by the insurer relates to something more particular than just the fact that certain drafts might have gone out from their financial office. So the question is, do you aggregate payments that the liability insurer made to all parties in connection with presumably that accident, or do you look at just the individual payments? And what the insurer wants to do, interestingly, is they want to aggregate all the liability payments made to anyone and then set them off against a per person limit.
Just a minute though, when you say paid to anyone, isn't what makes this case unique the fact that this is a wrongful death claim brought by the estate on behalf of the beneficiaries? which has been settled and paid, and now another claim's being asserted. So it's not like totally unrelated individuals who may have been, who may have claims.
I think you're right, Your Honor. I think that's exactly what, one of the things that has confused the insurer here is because it is a wrongful death claim, and frankly, distracted by laws in some other states that have different wrongful death rules and that have wrongful death claims being claims of the estate and derivative in nature, I think the insurer is somewhat confused. They are basically saying because there are other similar claims out there, there were other wrongful death claimants paid, we need to aggregate at least those similar ones. I don't know, frankly, I mean, the payments made to the estates themselves were not wrongful death payments. Those payments were surviving personal injury payments. But that argument is a little bit like saying, well, if a claimant has a UIM claim arising from a broken arm in a collision, then we're going to aggregate every payment made to anybody with a broken arm. I mean, the fact that there are other similar claims certainly doesn't mean that this person's claim is somehow compensated by monies paid to that other recipient. This court has already said that the staff...
Let me interrupt you, but along that same line, though, the argument is that the claimant is the personal representative for the wrongful death action, as opposed to each of the beneficiaries. Well, but, not necessarily the claimant, I think I'm using the wrong word, but that's who should be paid is the estate brought... The state is action brought by the personal representative on behalf of the beneficiaries. Therefore, there's only one payment to the estate.
Well, the payment, the personal representative of the deceased, of course, would have to be the named plaintiff in the tort action for wrongful death. But as this court is well aware, South Dakota has a long history of recognizing wrongful death claims as belonging to the statutory beneficiaries. And the fact that a tort claim would have to be brought in the name of a personal representative does not change the nature, the separate individual nature that this court has recognized in the claim that each surviving statutory next of kin has. And in focusing on the statute that relates to the set-off, this court has already said that the statute anticipates that the set-off provision will apply individually to each party entitled to recover. That's Westfield versus Roe, where the court looked at 5811.9.5 and acknowledged the need for a set-off, which everyone here agrees there is. And the court said, well, the statute anticipates that set-off would be handled individually. And of course, that statement makes perfect sense, because if the legislature had meant that all payments to anyone should be aggregated, or even that all payments to people with similar claims should be aggregated, it would have said in its set-off provision, essentially, that the coverage, instead of saying coverage is limited to the UIM limits, less the amount paid by the liability insurer, it could have simply said coverage shall be limited to the UIM coverage limits, less the liability coverage limits of the party recovered against. I mean, that's what the insurer is trying to accomplish here, is really just trying to set off the total limits. But the legislature didn't say that, and in fact adopted a different approach.
But it did say paid by, not paid to.
True, and it didn't say when or where either. I mean, it just said paid by. That's right. And the insurer...
Doesn't that suggest, though, paid by instead of paid to? That's a pretty strong argument, isn't it?
Well, every payment, respectfully, Your Honor, every payment that's paid by someone has to be paid to someone. And I think we need to look at this, the purpose then of the UIM statute to understand what is intended there. The purpose of the UIM law as a whole is to compensate people with uncompensated damages. So it would make no sense to say we're going to set off amounts paid by this same insurer to someone that's a stranger to this claim. If that didn't diminish the uncompensated damages of this claimant, it would make no sense to use that as part of the set-off.
Do you really think it was the intent of the legislature to hinge the liability of the insurance company based on the number of GLOW children that there are, that if they had 13 kids instead of three, that each one of those 13 would have been entitled to the same amount?
Oh, Your Honor, that's not at all what we're arguing. And in fact, that isn't the way it is under this policy, because the insurers, in the insurer in this case, there's a limit that says, the limit of liability says, no matter how many claimants or insureds, the most we'll ever pay for one death is $100,000. So the issue isn't, do they have to pay 13 times? It's how many pieces does that $100,000 get divided into? The insurer is able to contain and predict their damages because of the language that says, no matter how many claimants or insureds, this is the most we'll pay, the $100,000 per person, or if we're talking about per occurrence, of course, the $300,000. So no one is saying that there should be multiple per person limits. That is not the issue in this case. It is agreed that there should be one per person limit for each of the two claims we're talking about. The issue is, do you set off? Do you give the UIM carrier credit for liability payments paid to someone else that don't in any way compensate this insured for his uncompensated damages? Judge Batty in the Winters case talked about that purpose, and his quote is brief, but I think it's insightful. To aggregate each plaintiff's recovery with the other and preclude underinsured status not only would be contrary to the weight of legal authority on this issue, but also would be directly opposed to the legislative intent of UIM coverage in providing an insured with maximum coverage. Reminding us, of course, that another more general purpose of the UIM law is maximum coverage. So it makes no sense, if that's the purpose, that we're going to have arbitrary set-offs for liability payments to someone else whose claim is totally separate and in no way compensates this insured. The cases already decided indicate that the proper approach is an individual approach. In Farmland, incidentally, which is a deceased wife and her husband making a claim, this court adopted language of the Minnesota court, and the language quoted in the South Dakota Farmland opinion says, paid to an insured, that the set-off is the amount paid to an insured, and is quoting at length from the Broughton case in Minnesota. If you look at the Broughton case that this court relied on, the court in that case expresses great concern about this notion of aggregating everyone else's payments for the set-off, or a shorthand way to do it would be just subtracting the limits of coverage. And the Broughton case discusses at length the risk of that it would make no sense, because just as Judge Batty pointed out, you then will be depleting UIM coverage based on payments made to someone else by liability insurer. But besides the Farmland language that says paid to an insured, the Winters case that I just cited held you do not aggregate. You don't aggregate the liability payments made to several claimants when you're subtracting the set-off against a UIM stated limit. The federal case of Austin Mutual versus King is another case that indicates the proper approach is an individual approach. In that case, the liability carrier paid its limits of coverage. There were several different claimants, and there was a total of only $100,000 liability coverage. It was divided among several different claimants. The claimants then made, all the passengers at least in one of the vehicles, made a claim under the same UIM policy, and it had a limit of $100,000 of UIM coverage. And the insurer there tried to say, well, we need to set off for each claimant. We need to set off the total amount that the liability carrier paid to everyone as a result of this accident. The district court said no, and the Eighth Circuit affirmed, saying that isn't the way you do it. You look at the policy language, and you see, is the focus of the policy language on individual claims or on the aggregate? And you look at three things. The Austin versus King opinion said you look at the insuring agreement, you look at the definition of underinsured motorist, and you look at the limit of liability language. And what was important in the Austin versus King case was that those three things read together, and of course we need to look at the policy as a whole, make it clear that the focus was on individual claimants' claims. And the limit of liability language in that policy said, subject to the per person limit, the per occurrence limit applies. I make that point because when this court decided Westfield versus Roe, and as I noted earlier, expressed the understanding of the statute, that the statute anticipates individual set-offs. The court went on to say, and in Westfield versus Roe, there could have been coverage, but in that case, it looked at the policy and there was only a single limit, a per occurrence limit. And so it distinguished Austin versus King and said, because in that particular case, there's only a per occurrence, we'll look at the per occurrence, and then we'll set off the total amount paid for that occurrence. In this case, if the insurer were here saying, well, we want to set off everything that the liability insurer has paid, we want to set off the $425 that they paid for that occurrence, they ought to be talking about setting it off against the per occurrence limit of $300,000. Frankly, at that point, they'd have greater exposure. They'd have $175,000 instead of what we're arguing their exposure is, which is roughly $60,000 on each claim. But the insurer cannot cite a single case. There is not a single case cited that interprets UIM coverage in the way it's asking this court to do so. In every single case they have cited, the California case, the West Virginia case, and every other case, the UIM carrier paid one per person limit, and the only issue was, do you get more than one per person limit when you have multiple wrongful death beneficiaries? That was the issue in all the cases that the UIM carrier is citing. And no one is standing here saying there should be multiple per person limits. We're agreeing, you'll recall at the outset, I said we're agreeing there's a $100,000 per person limit applicable to each of the two claims. And we're agreeing that from that, he should be, Michael Glow's coverage should be reduced by the amount he's already been paid because the statute and the policy only deals with uncompensated damages. But there's nothing in the statute, there's nothing in the policy that suggests his coverage should be depleted because someone else got compensated for their damages. No one is trying to sell multiple limits here.
Well, you just mentioned something that reminded me. This case is a little unusual because it's the third case we've had out of this automobile accident. Are the other children or siblings? I guess they're not children anymore. But are they asserting claims like this one?
No.
Individual claims.
No, Your Honor. And the essentially, well, they're all three asserting claims. Do you mean under this policy?
Yeah.
No. Michael Glow is the only one that has asserted that, and that has to do primarily with the priority of policies. If there were other siblings, there are only three. I'll predict there's no more. I'm not going to load any more caseload out of this collision on the court. But if there were a fourth or a fifth sibling that didn't have their own policy to claim under and they were claiming under this, then certainly that sibling's claim would compete with Michael Glow's claim for a single per person limit. I don't think there's any question about that. But the other siblings have asserted claims under their own policy because that would be the priority, as I understand it, as to how the policies would come into play. And given Nickerson, once they've collected under their policies, they would make no claim here. I think a key point to bear in mind is that the insurer here knew full well that South Dakota's statute does not simply say you take the UIM limits and then you subtract the liability limits. And that's really what they're trying to do here. They're trying to come in the back door to do something they can't do in the front door. They're trying to say, well, even though the statute doesn't say you subtract limits, we're going to, in effect, subtract limits because first we're going to require that all the liability coverage be exhausted. And so by definition, the liability limits will have been paid. And then we're going to subtract the total amount of liability payments paid to anyone. Voila, they're subtracting the limits. The legislature did not choose that approach for our UIM statute. It instead chose the amount paid, focusing on the underinsured claimant. And one of the ways we know the insurer knows that is because if you look at the UIM endorsement that they write generally, it's not particular to South Dakota, their UIM endorsement has a definition of underinsured motorist that says you look at the limits of the UIM limits and you see if they're greater than the liability limits. it knows that won't apply in South Dakota, and under its South Dakota endorsement, it changes that definition. And its own UIM definition says that you look at the amount of UIM limits minus the amount paid to the insured. That is right in the endorsement that this company adopted to comply with South Dakota law. It says that to define a UIM driver, you look at the amount of limits, UIM limits, minus the amount paid to the UIM insured. And so it adopted that endorsement, knowing that's required by our law, and yet it then tries to essentially negate that endorsement by arguing what no court has ever agreed to in the past, and that is that you should aggregate other folks' payments to use as a set-off.
How would it have worked had more than just your client claimed under this?
How it would have worked? I think the way it would have worked, Your Honor, is that according to Austin Mutual and Winters, it appears that the way that it would work is that each claimant would assert a claim starting with $100,000, subtract the amount they were paid, and then whatever the resulting amounts were, you would add those together, and to the extent that the total of those does not exceed $100,000, they would be paid. But there is clear language that says that for any one injury or death, any one bodily injury or death, $100,000 is the most.
So at the most, I mean, his could be reduced then, is that
right? If he had a sibling coming in, they would compete for the same dollars at some point. It's obviously as soon as...
For the remaining $60,000?
No, I think they would each have a $60,000 claim, but they would be competing for $100,000, and so obviously each of them would not be totally satisfied. Okay. I mean, I think you'd start with the $100,000, subtract what each of them were paid, and they were paid equal amounts, let's say $40,000, so you've got a net of $60,000, but the $120,000 exceeds the $100,000 per person limit, and so the company would not have to pay more than $100,000, and they'd have to either
so
agree or sort that out.
They'd only be liable for another $20,000.
I'm sorry?
They'd only be liable for another $20,000, right?
Well, I don't think the UIM carrier would be even liable for that other $20,000. I think their language clearly limits them to $100,000 is the most they will pay. They've never paid a dollar, so we've got the full $100,000 to use, but I wouldn't contend we have more than $100,000 to use on anyone, I mean, for the, say, just for the death of the father.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Beck. Mr. Lindy, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Your Honor, I think the first issue to address somewhat in reply to Mr. Glow's claim is that the Roe decision. In the Roe decision, this court considered the language of a Westfield policy. It was a single limits policy with $500,000 available in underinsured motorist coverage. The Roes both died in a traffic accident, I think in Arizona. They were hit by a tractor trailer. They both died, and the estates brought a claim against the truck owner, and his liability insurer paid $750,000. The Rose claimed that they were entitled to, I guess, what they first claimed, that there were 13 claims being made in the case. What they claim that each wrongful death beneficiary had a claim. And in note 2 of this court's opinion in that case, the court concluded that each wrongful death beneficiary is not a beneficiary under the policy. The court then considered the argument that was made by the Rose. In that case, they argued that, well, we only received, you know, there was two different personal representatives, we only received $375,000 apiece. So we offset that against $750,000. The court considered the policy, which was a $500,000 hold policy. In addition, it considered the offset clause in the limit of liability language, which is almost exactly what the union limit of liability language is, and found that no, all sums paid means all sums paid. You take the $750,000, you offset that against the $500,000, it's more than the $500,000 so that you don't have an underinsured motorist claim. In addition, Mr. Glow's attorney speaks about the Winters case. The Winters case is different from this situation. In the Winters case, what happened was that there was two people that were injured in an accident. Both of them lived after the accident, but they were both injured and suffered bodily injury in the accident. One of the insurers made an unusual argument in that case. Essentially, they said the insurance company had $300,000 in limits. And I don't know where they came up with this argument, but this is what the insurance company argued. They argued, well, we take the amount we paid to first person injured in the accident, and we take the amount paid to second person injured in the accident. That totals $400,000. We offset that against our single limit policy in this case. The court rejected that and said, no, those people were injured in the accident. They're each entitled to $100,000 apiece because they were only paid by the liability insurer for the tortfeasor, $200,000 per person. Also in the...
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Also in the Austin Mutual case, that involved a situation, and it, you know, all these underinsured motorist claims are usually very tragic situations, and I think that one involved seven people that were injured in a severe motor vehicle accident. Three of them died in the accident. And what the insurance company was essentially saying is that they would only have to pay $100,000. They had a per occurrence liability limit, but there was $50,000 per person. And each of the people making claims, which included in that case, and the Eighth Circuit considered it, three people that died. Now, the Eighth Circuit didn't go back and look at the amount that was paid to each beneficiary. Instead, they looked at the seven people that were injured in the accident and said, if you have these people injured, each of them is entitled to their own limit under the policy. That's what the Austin Mutual case, it just simply doesn't address the situation where you have a wrongful death beneficiary because all the people were injured in that accident.
What is your response to Ms. Turbak's claim that your insurance company made a special endorsement on their policy in this state to comply with our uninsured motorist coverage, which includes the language paid to the insured?
I guess the response is that there is a policy in our, or there is a endorsement in the insurance policy that provides that an underinsured motorist vehicle is defined as Ms. Turbak has defined it. However, I think that that provision still needs to be read with the whole policy. I mean, that just doesn't change, you know, because they put a different endorsement in the state of South Dakota in, that doesn't change how offset amounts are considered or what the maximum liability is. Because I think if the court considers the maximum liability and the offset amount, that reads exactly as the South Dakota statute reads. Essentially, you get the $100,000 and then all sums paid by the tortfeasor's insurer is offset against that amount. In this case, the $125,000 is offset against the $100,000. So I think, you know, you can parse out that piece of language and say, well, it's different. But I think when you consider the limit of liability provision and the offset provision in the policy, it's entirely consistent with 5811.9.5. So I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to take parts and pieces out of the policy and say that there's an underinsured claim. Additionally, I want to address the argument I think that is being made that we don't have any authority to support this position. Well, I think that there's adequate authority, and I think there's authority cited in our brief. And I think if the court looks at the West Virginia decision and the Mississippi decision, there's also a California decision and a Washington decision. And basically what those courts state is that the wrongful death beneficiary doesn't get his own personal limits. And that's the only way I can, and maybe I'm confused, but the only way I can understand this argument that is being made in this claim by Michael Glow is that he has his own limit. Because if he wasn't claiming that, then the $100,000 that is paid on behalf of his parents under the policy, your first $100,000 is offset by the $125,000 for Verna Glow. Your second one is for Larry Glow, $100,000. It's offset by the $125,000. And I think if the court considers those decisions from the other jurisdictions, they basically conclude that each claimant does not get his own limit under the single limits. Essentially, you pay out based upon you know, the single limit that's sitting out there. And I mean, it does get a little confusing considering that, but I think what essentially Michael Glow's argument is, it's kind of a backdoor of that argument saying, well, you only consider the amount paid to the wrongful death beneficiary, when in fact what you're doing is you're essentially, because the language of the policy is clear, what essentially you're doing is you're giving him a separate limit and then limiting his offset to the amount that he was paid. Because the plain language of the policy says $100,000 is our maximum limit of liability, offset by $125,000, which is the amount that the liability insurers for Donald Huber paid. And I think what Mr. Glow has done is, I think he's relied on this Broughton case to somewhat, you know, come in and say, well, it's the amount that you paid to the insured. That's our statute is not a difference of the limit statute. But I think clearly we've cited to a number of decisions by this court where it specifically recognizes South Dakota as a difference in the limit state. So I don't know if it's recognizing that South Dakota is a difference in the limit state, how we can argue that what it really is it amounts to basically the Minnesota statute that the court considered in Broughton. And I think one of the things is that the argument that Heitman somehow adopted this Broughton decision is misplaced. And I think going back to Justice Saber's question, where the trial court erred is it relied too heavily on language that this court cited in the Heitman decision. And this court cited heavily from the Broughton decision, which included language saying that you consider the amount paid to the insured. Now, as I previously stated, this Broughton decision did not deal with this issue. What it dealt with was the timing of payments to reject the actual argument by the Heitmans, who were the insureds in the case. Basically, that Broughton decision was straight on the issue of whether timing of payment mattered. And in this court's decision, it cited some language from the Broughton decision where, you know, the holding of the Broughton decision included, you know, citation to their statute and reliance on their statute where he looked at the amounts paid to the insured. However, I think if you consider the statute in South Dakota, 5811-9.5, Heitman and their reliance on Broughton in no way changed what the statute is. And I think the point is the statute provides what you must consider, and what you must consider is the amount paid by the liability insurer on behalf of Donald Huber. And that, in this case, is $125,000. You don't look at what the amount was received by a wrongful death beneficiary, and I don't think there's any authority cited by Mr. Glow that would allow this court to look at that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lundy. The court will be in recess for approximately 10 minutes.